Jesus Christ was a man that traveled through the land, carpenter true and brave. Said to the rich, give your goods to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand.
And this is Here We Stand once again. I'm your host, Kevin Annett. That was our buddy Woody Guthrie from back in the 30s, telling it like it is, just like Jesus did. And we are here, back again, just before the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. We're going to get into that today on our show entitled The Oldest Lie and the Greatest Crime, Ending the Reign of the False Church. My guest today is Andrew Patterson. And Katie Stoker was scheduled to be on, but she wasn't able to make it today. So we have back with us in a few minutes Andrew Patterson, another frontline fighter and brother, who's been on the show a few times talking about how he asked the Canadian government a simple question: will my tax money be used to further genocide? And instead of answering that question like any honorable people would, they went after him. And he's talked about that before on the show, and it comes down to personal responsibility. Are we going to take responsibility for ourselves and the world? Well, that's going to be a big subject for today when we're looking at these false churches and things done in our name with our tax money still today, brothers and sisters. To remind you, next week's show, November 5th, it's daylight savings time, so knock those clocks back an hour or you're going to miss the show. And before Andrew comes on, I also wanted to remind people to follow our work, itccs.org, murderbydecree.com. Today, all over the world, people are beginning a 48-hour fast and prayer to pull people out of the false churches, the churches of Rome, of England, of Canada, those that have committed genocide and are trafficking children and murdering people as we speak. These crimes are something that go beyond the rational. These are things that strike at our very sense of decency. The worst abomination is committed by those who have a public trust, who have a higher standard of trust to live by, which these churches are supposed to. As a matter of fact, the basis for churches not paying taxes is that they are institutions of public trust, that are supposed to care for people, that are supposed to live according to higher morality. Well, these same churches have sterilized and flogged to death children. They've assaulted them. They've trafficked them. They've denied them food and water so they die. These are some of the crimes that the churches in Canada, for example, have committed on generations, not just for 1 or 2 years, friends, but for over 100 years. They slaughtered 60,000 Aboriginal children. And guess what? They got away with it. Now, there's a basic moral question there beyond the whole injustice and criminality of it, and that is, how could they do it in the first place? They claim to be followers of Jesus and devout people, and yet they are raping and trafficking and torturing and killing children. So how could it happen in the first place? A, that's the first issue. B, how could they then stay silent about it until the point at which they began to get sued? Okay, what does that tell you? Are they bothered by it? No, or wouldn't have continued for so long. And then C, after they're confronted about it, they weasel their way out of it by hiding behind their lawyers. They get the government to take the fall, and not one of them ever goes to trial. And guess what? Point D. They operate every day, going to their churches, singing their little hymns, and pretending they're nice and healed and reconciled people. You know, these are dead souls. There's no way around it. When you look at it, these are people who don't have their own soul or are so dissociated from their own reality and who they are that they might as well be crazy. This is kind of a fundamental moral issue, folks, and it has to do with not just the obvious stuff, but what we tolerate in our midst. It's really a question of us, because we're the ones who tolerate it. We're the ones who've let them get off the hook. Well, most of us have. Some of us have been fighting relentlessly at the cost of everything to bring this truth out, because we know it involves our crimes. We're not speaking for anybody. We're not speaking for the natives. We are speaking to our own culture and people, because the crime came out of us and will continue and is continuing because we're not facing that. That is a fundamental question we're going to be looking at today. And we're also going to arm people, like we always do on the show, with practical means to do something about it. For example, today, in churches all over Canada and the world, they're being handed a statement. And the statement allows people who go to the Catholic, Anglican, or United churches to fill out a pledge form. The pledge form says, I, so-and-so, after prayer and in good faith, hereby pledge to disassociate myself from your church and to deny it all attendance, funding, and adherence. I do so because of its criminal conviction as a genocidal child-killing institution that has betrayed God and humanity, and thereby forfeited all legitimacy, rights, and authority. I pledge by this separation to pursue my faith in the company of others who have also taken this pledge, so help me God. People fill it out, drop it in the collection plate, and say bye-bye, no more money to the church. But it's also directed those people who might consider renting these facilities. There's a boycott on these churches, and there has been for a number of years, especially now after their criminal conviction. So if you want to get a copy of this pledge, and also stand-down orders to the officers of this church, public cease and desist orders to those taking part in these genocidal institutions, please write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. See more at itccs.org, kevinannett.com. Now, I understand Brother Andrew is on the line now with us. Hey, Andrew.
How are you, Kevin?
I'm good. How about
good.
You?
Good. Great, thanks. Great. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, well, it's good to be on the air and still alive and kicking.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you were listening, but I said in the intro that this is really a moral question. That really baffles the imagination how people can do these crimes under the name of God, Christ, or whoever, and then stand there and pretend it never happened, basically. Say, we're absolved now, we're feeling good about ourselves. I mean, what's your kind of moral take on this before we get into any of this?
Well, I think you've nailed it. It is a moral issue, and we duck the moral question individually by saying it's not our responsibility. We didn't do it. We're not beneficiaries of the crime, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, what Roger Waters was in Vancouver a couple of nights ago playing and somewhere along the line pointing out that he was performing on unceded Coast Salish territory. And that's great. You know, that's a nice recognition of some truth. But what does it buy anybody at the end of the day? What it's supposed to be, of course, is a wake-up call. I mean, Roger can't do it all on his own. None of us can. He's playing his part by shining a light on the moral responsibility that we each face. And George Carlin addressed this when he said the one class of people that he never made fun of was politicians.
Right.
He said that there was no point because they were the best we could do, the best we could expect, because they were a reflection of the masses. His point being that unless we address our own morality, our own choices, our own corruption. You know, it's a scale, it's a matter of degree in all of us. That's the human condition. That's really what we're talking about. And that's what
right.
he's saying. Until we clean up our own act, don't expect leaders to be anything but who they are. So you can beat up Mr. Trump or Mr. Obama or Mr. Trudeau or Mr. Harper or whoever you care. Tony Blair, doesn't matter. They're those people are put as actors in place in political theater and give us a place to vent our spleen. It's easier to point the finger and blame somebody else for our troubles than to look in the mirror, be accountable to ourselves, and then decide what we're going to do, knowing that none of us are perfect. We've all made mistakes. You know, doing what's done at these higher levels, you can hardly characterize as a mistake, so get over it. If, you know, you've had some issues in the past, fine. It's not the same as bonded pedo sadism, which is really what we're witnessing,
right.
that the people at the top end are held in play, are compromised along the way, and will do as they're told because of this vast child trafficking conspiracy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, it's funny, Andrew, because, you know, this whole issue of how people live alongside their own crime and pretend it's not there, pretend a whole history is not there. I saw a news item in Port Alberni, which is where, for me, this was the seat of the crime, where it all began. They've had a debate on city council recently. They want to change the street name, and of course this is in vogue these days. The politically correct thing is to take down statues of politically incorrect people, change street names. They want to change the street name from Neil, N-E-I-L-L, because it's named after an Indian agent, A.W. Neil, who brought kids into the residential school. But at the same article, they talk about the Alberni Residential School where, quote, physical and sexual abuse occurred. not mass murder, not sterilizations, not medical experiments, as we've proven time and again. So, you know, this whole politically correct thing is a way to really whitewash our own history to pretend it didn't happen. Oh, look, we've got a street name that's native now, so we're good people. I mean,
yeah, that, we're not beneficiaries of the crime, and also trying to fob it off on the individual deviant. Sure, lots of those, right. And that's who they were employed. But again, it's brushing aside the fact that it was an organized plan. It was a deliberate. Just that. It was a deliberate plan. It was carried out by various agencies. We know it was designed primarily by the Catholic Church. We know that the government of Canada had it all done on their behalf. Yeah, the research you've done has shown this beyond any shadow of a doubt. Anybody who questions the criminal nature of this Corporation of Canada doesn't have to do much digging these days. So the work has been done. The heavy lifting's done. It's really just a matter of research. I want to go back to the morality for a bit, because I think the place to turn to is the Nuremberg Tribunal, the Nuremberg Principles, the seven that came out of them. And I'd like to go into them, because I heard someone discussing them the other day and saying that's probably the most important document that came out of the last century. Because in this human condition of good and evil, while perhaps we haven't necessarily defined what good is, this document does a really good job of starting to define what evil is and something to stand on with regard to international law and to take a moral stand. And so if it's all right with you, I'd like to go through them, because I think it gives people a good starting place in terms of asking questions, how to take a lawful stand and ask questions of the people who are making demands of us and making claims of us.
Yeah, I
turn
think
around
it's definitely...
and ask the right questions and demand the answers. That the radio show
right.
personality says something like that for his ad. Well, there you go. There's an answer, folks. Is learn how to ask some of these questions, and don't take their feet off the fire until they're properly answered.
Okay, now let's get into that, Andrew. But just as a bit of background for listeners, we are going to, as the first part of our show today, we're going to look into the history, and this, of course, the Nuremberg precedents are part of that history, but. To understand what exactly these churches are, we have to see there's a triangle between church, state, and the corporate sector. Because, and I'm going to give an example of that after your talk, but it's really a whole corporatocracy. It isn't just church as people know it, where you go to church on Sunday. These are corporate institutions with a whole history of planned genocide that goes back centuries. So just as that prelude, go ahead, talk about Nuremberg.
Well, in fact, yes, historically, let's remember that the priest and banking classes were one and the same.
Yep.
And so this is nothing new that we're dealing with, and so, again, to be clear, you know, politics is theater, and it's really just a charade put on by the bankers to keep people distracted. There's studies done at Princeton University showing the United States is not a democracy, it's at best an oligarchy, and we can go further. So we have to keep that in mind in terms of remembering if there's one thing that is wanted of us is to be fighting each other and hurting and killing each other.
Right.
And that we have to make sure we don't go down that path, because that's exactly, if we do, that's exactly where they want us. It doesn't serve.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want, do you want to talk about the church structure and the corporate structure first, or do you want to get into these principles as a basis for a place to stand, and you know, in case there's any question in someone's mind what to stand on, I think these seven principles.
I want to get to Nuremberg, definitely, but let me just start by going back even further,
sure.
And looking at what organized religion is, because it's really interesting. There was an article that came out in Science magazine last year. It was quoted in the New York Times. I'm just reading an article from it. It's entitled "The Rise of Great Nations Tied to Ritual Killing." And they showed that as state-level societies developed with kings and empires and armies and all that, you saw a corresponding rise, and in fact preceded by, ritual sacrificial killing. That is, religion saying these people have to die in order for the society to be prosperous. Now, an example of that is the Hebrew word kadesh, which means two things. It means to sanctify something. It also means to sacrifice something. So the idea is, you make something holy by spilling the blood of another person. And it was that practice that led to the rise of modern states. So in other words, religions, you know, one way to look at genocide, it's simply ritual killing designed to you know, secure the power of a given class or empire. And so what we realize is that these kind of ritual killings, that really was what genocide is all about, is part and parcel of who we've been for thousands of years. It's not some aberration. It's right intrinsic in the way we think and act and feel. We prosper through the suffering and death of others, whether it's through slavery, war, genocide, whatever, racism. It's really part of who we've been for thousands of years. So I think that's important to keep in mind, because, you know, people always say, well, Hitler was an aberration, the residential schools are an aberration. No, they're really coming right out of our culture. So I just wanted to say that first.
Well, sure. I think it's been going on for a very long time. To simplify what we're dealing with, humans are pack animals, or if you prefer, gangs. So the human history is a story of gangs and gang warfare. You know, whether we're going to evolve past that, I mean, you know, who was it, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh summed it up by saying that man is asleep, and unless man wakes up, there can be no possibility. That's the threshold we're on. Are we going to wake up or not? It's not a given. And move beyond the need for gang warfare, or just carry on and look at the leader of North Korea today, who's saying he's not going to get rid of his nuke, because today, as a gang, if you don't have a nuclear weapon, you're not a player.
Yeah.
Take a look at, you know, Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi. What happens if you're a gang leader without a nuke?
Well, the interesting thing too, Andrew, is that the biggest criminals in history always have God on their side.
Of course.
And religion itself, it's kind of like the child raping uncle who everybody likes because he gives gifts at Christmas time. But there he is in the background. He's got the best reputation. He's the worst criminal in the family. That's what churches are, and it's been proven time again. And yet, nobody feels able to take these people on. Like, what I find interesting is that even if you go to atheists, even if you go to people who consider themselves very progressive and aware, the minute you talk about taking away the tax-exempt status of these murderous churches, they balk. They say, oh, well, we can't be anti-religious. Well, why not? You know, when they got blood on their hands. Anyway,
well, it's funny you mentioned the blood ritual. I remember watching on TV a few years ago the Queen and a bunch of other leaders visiting
Vimy Memorial.
Monument that's been built. That's right. And I remember the Queen talking about this land made sacred by the spilling of blood.
Yeah, right. There you go.
And so, you know, straight up, you're saying that essentially this is the site of a large blood sacrifice, and that's why we're here today to perpetuate that ritual.
Right. And of course, we know that the practicing of satanic rituals is very close to the practice of the Catholic Mass. The idea that the blood of the innocent, whether it be Christ or a child, will bring out life, eternal life, that's intrinsic in both satanic and Catholic Masses. And so it's a very short step from one to the other, and we found that in practice when we're on, you know, documenting the Ninth Circle cult and these other ritual killings that occur within the Catholic Church. I mean, there's too many examples now for people to deny it anymore. And,
sure.
And these are crimes against humanity, which leads us into Nuremberg. Talk about Nuremberg.
Sure. The seven principles that came out of the trial, we can read the whole thing in a couple of minutes. It's barely over one page. It's one legal page long, and I think we should
just sum up. Yeah,
through
sum
it.
Up.
Well, let's start with the first one. The first principle is that any person who commits an act which constitutes a crime under international law is responsible, therefore, and liable to punishment. So there we go. We establish that international law exists. The second principle, to sum it up, says the fact that an internal law does not impose a penalty for an act which constitutes a crime under international law does not relieve the person who committed the act from responsibility under international law. So establishing the precedents of order, that international law is superior to national law. So there's a question. Let's stop there for a sec. There's a question that we can ask any civil servant or anyone who's making a demand is just that. Are you subject to international law? Are your acts subject to international law? Just ask them. If they say they don't know what you mean, say, well, find out. When you do, would you get back to me then?
Well, the Revenue Canada people refuse to answer you when you ask them that.
Sure, of course. You know, just flat out and say our job is to uphold certain statutes, and they won't look at anything else. So essentially what they're trying to establish is that they're not subject to international law.
Yeah, okay.
And when you consider that, bear in mind that, here we are coming up to November, Armistice Day, that the whole message is lest we forget. And yet, if we forget the Nuremberg Principle, we have forgotten. It means that the people who died fighting to protect our freedoms and liberties and the rule of law will have died in vain if we don't start applying what essentially is the document that came out of all that suffering and loss.
Well, one of the interesting things I found about the Seven Nuremberg Principles is one that says no one is obligated to obey an order.
Let's get to that.
Yeah, okay.
Number three, because like I said, there's only seven. We're already up to number three. The fact that a person who committed an act which constitutes a crime under international law acted as head of state or responsible government official does not relieve him from responsibility under international law. So again, doing away with excuses. And the next, and here's the one that you're talking about. Number four, the fact that a person acted pursuant to order of his government or of a superior does not relieve him from responsibility under international law, provided a moral choice was in fact possible to him. Here we go. It's about morality. If you have the ability to make a moral choice, international law makes it mandatory.
Right.
Absolutely mandatory. It's clear.
And they don't say unless... with the exception of if you're a member of a church. I mean, it's assumed that all institutions are covered by this, secular, religious, whatever.
Right. That, principle 5 says you're entitled to a fair trial. Principle 6 goes on to establish the crimes that are punishable as crimes under international law. People can look them all up, but essentially crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Those are the three categories. And it's broken down, and we can go into it. Let me just take one. Murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, or other inhuman acts done against any civilian population, or persecutions on political, racial, or religious grounds. I mean, the list goes on, right?
Well, when we apply that to the specific crimes we're talking about in Canada, a plan written down in 1910, a contract in Ottawa saying these so-called residential schools will be run by the churches with government authorization.
Mm-hmm.
It says right in the contract that the main purpose is not to provide education, but religious indoctrination.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought in all these laws, which, of course, if anyone's read murderbydecree.com, you'll see that medical examinations were abolished, no health inspections in the schools, everything put under the authority of the principal. Sterilization laws brought in, allowing any Indian in these schools to be legally sterilized,
mm-hmm.
And on, these kinds of things. Lawyers were not allowed to hire Indians as clients, or they'd go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And,
get disbarred,
All of it shows a clear, deliberate intent to wipe out a people, that is the non-Christian Aboriginal people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yet... Was that ever talked about in any of the so-called truth and reconciliation stuff? No, it was all whitewashed, the entire thing. And that in itself is a crime, which we're going to talk about, the cover-up.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Concealment of a crime is just as much a crime as the crime itself.
Yeah.
That's the question. How many war crimes does a man have to commit before you convict him of being a war criminal?
Well, yeah. The funny thing is, I remember years ago, before... we got the government to finally respond and say, oh, yeah, well, thousands of children did die. I remember going out to Port Alberni after being fired from there and talking to one of the Mounties there, and I said, well, we have eyewitnesses saying there were children buried in behind the school. We've had forensic team go in and find ground-penetrating radar and found sinkholes. There's a lot of evidence there's kids back there. And the Mounties said, oh, no, there aren't. And I said, how do you know? Have you done any examination? And he said, well... We don't have to. And that's literally what the cop said to me.
Yeah.
And, it reminds me, like the other day I got a call from somebody, I won't say where in Canada, but it shows you the regime we're living under now. This man wrote to the government saying, I don't feel that I'm obligated to stand under Crown law anymore because the Queen Elizabeth is a convicted criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And That was at 10:30 in the morning. At 3 p.m., the police show up and take his children away.
Right.
They're put in a foster home. They then tell him that they're being abused in this foster home. And when he makes a complaint about it, there's a psychiatric nurse and two cops come to his door and say, if you talk about this publicly, we're going to incarcerate you in a mental hospital. So, first of all, his kids are targeted, like mine were. Political dissidents have their children taken from them. And then they're threatened with incarceration if they talk about it. Mm-hmm. That's Canada this last month, okay?
Yeah.
That's what we're living under. And it's because, you know, if you let the crimes of the past carry on, they'll continue if you don't confront your own dirt.
Well, Canada is going down the slippery slope of collectivism. We're a long ways down there, and it's yesterday I was actually looking up Section 39 of the Criminal Code, Claim of Right, and it got repealed in 2012. It's a common law concept that used to be codified in the Criminal Code, and it's now been taken out. And it's essentially, you know, the lawful excuse, you know, the idea that you can commit what would ordinarily be a crime to protect the well-being of another, and you're off the hook. The idea, and it's been recodified elsewhere. So, for example, someone's attacking somebody else, and you pull them off, and you hurt the attacker. Under ordinary circumstances, that might be an assault, but if you're doing it to come to the aid of another, it's not. Well, that whole piece is now been taken out, and so what we're seeing is a continued statutory attack on the common law, to the point where eventually time will have gone by far enough that people have forgotten that there is a common law, and that Canada is still a common law jurisdiction. For how much longer is the open question. I mean, with the passing of C-51 a few years ago, giving Health Canada authority, you know, the reason we raised the alarm all those years ago is because if that act was allowed to pass under the Harper regime, and it did, Health Canada inspectors would be given state authorities that circumvented due process in Canada, circumvented the courts. And that's come to pass. So now Health Canada inspectors can come in without a court order and come into a private residence or a place of business and seize consumer goods for the consumer's protection.
Right.
You can't go to the court to get an order to get your possessions back. You can't do anything. Then they can actually charge you for storing your stuff, and there's nothing you can do.
Right. Well, we all know now that we're not under the rule of law in Canada or really anywhere else,
no.
But it's got to be created. And that's kind of what I want to do in the last half of the show, talk about alternatives, what we've achieved so far, and maybe some alternatives. I want to take a short break, Andrew. We're going to listen to our friend George Carlin. A little piece called Kill for God. We'll be back after it.
But you know, the longer you listen to this abortion debate, the more you hear this phrase, sanctity of life. You've heard that, sanctity of life. You believe in it? Personally, I think it's a bunch of shit. Well, I mean, life is sacred? Who said so? God? Hey, if you read history, you realize that God is one of the leading causes of death. Has been for thousands of years. Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Christians, all taking turns killing each other because God told them it was a good idea. The sword of God, the blood of the Lamb, vengeance is mine. Millions of dead motherfuckers. Millions of dead motherfuckers, all because they gave the wrong answer to the God question. You believe in God? No. Dead. You believe in God? Yes. You believe in my God? No. Dead. My God has a bigger dick than your God. Thousands of years. Thousands of years. And all the best wars, too. The bloodiest, most brutal wars fought, all based on religious hatred. Which is fine with me, hey? Anytime a bunch of holy people want to kill each other, I'm a happy guy. But don't be giving me all this shit about the sanctity of life. I mean, even if there were such a thing, I don't think it's something you can blame on God. Now, you know where the sanctity of life came from? We made it up. You know why? Because we're alive. Self-interest. Living people have a strong interest in promoting the idea that somehow life is sacred. You don't see Abbott and Costello running around talking about this shit, do you? We're not hearing a whole lot from Mussolini on the subject. What's the latest from JFK? Not a goddamn thing. Because JFK, Mussolini, and Abbott and Costello are fucking dead. They're fucking dead. And dead people give less than a shit about the sanctity of life. Only living people care about it, so the whole thing grows out of a completely biased point of view. It's a self-serving, man-made bullshit story. It's one of these things we tell ourselves so we'll feel noble. Life is sacred. Makes you feel noble. But let me ask you this. If everything that ever lived is dead, and everything alive is going to die, where does the sacred part come in? I'm having trouble with that. Because, I mean, even with the stuff we preach about the sanctity of life, we don't practice it. We don't practice it. Look at what we kill. Mosquitoes and flies, because they're pests. Lions and tigers, because it's fun. Chickens and pigs, because we're hungry. Pheasants and quails, because it's fun. And we're hungry. And people, we kill people. Because they're pests. And it's fun. And you might have noticed something else. The sanctity of life doesn't seem to apply to cancer cells, does it? You rarely see a bumper sticker that says, save the tumors. Or I break for advanced melanoma. Viruses, mold, mildew, maggots, fungus, weeds, E. coli bacteria, the crabs. Nothing sacred about those things. So at best, the sanctity of life is kind of a selective thing. We get to choose which forms of life we feel are sacred, and we get to kill the rest. Pretty neat deal, huh? You know how we got it? We made the whole fucking thing up!
And we're back, good old George. I like that one especially because it shows the self-serving nature of morality, especially
sure.
religious morality. Yeah. And we have so many examples of that. Ever since I was a kid, I just cringe. I cannot stand hypocrisy. And starting with myself, I mean, I shine the light on myself first. And,
absolutely, yeah.
You know, that's the only place where any kind of change can begin, if you start with yourself and then build upward. I wanted to talk for a minute, Andrew, about how the fact that people know what the crimes are. We already know the problem. Like you've said, we've documented it so well over the years. I don't want to rehash a lot of the crimes because people who may not know them just have to go to murderbydecree.com, get our book, read it. It's online. You don't even have to pay for it. And I often say to people, well, the Canadian government charged us $68 million to run a fake inquiry that didn't produce anything. Hell, I found out more stuff just working on my own. I didn't charge anybody anything. So it shows you that that kind of information is out there if you want to find it. The problem is not that. It's the fact that the very same people who did the crime have now been covering it up with the same kind of tag-team operation. The church and government covered for each other during the residential school genocide. Now they're still covering for each other. They nominated... You know, it's like the serial killer nominating the jury and the judge. The churches and government nominate the commissioners for the TRC, and then they claim it's some kind of unbiased body. But let's talk a little bit about that, our sense of not only how it's been covered up, but how the cover-up itself has been forgotten, so that people are in this state of mind now almost like these crimes never happened, or it's all behind us and we're so much better people now. Let's talk a
sure.
little bit about that.
Sure, and let's give it the heading of Principle 7 from the Nuremberg Principles, because it covers this part of the conversation perfectly. It's one sentence. Complicity in the commission of a crime against peace, a war crime, or a crime against humanity as set forth in Principle 6, is a crime under international law. So there it is. Complicity is what we're talking about. Complicity between church and state, and between the various agencies. And you would have to say that carrying on the cover-up today is a continuing crime. The complicity is continuing, so support for any agency or regime that's committing this complicity in hiding the crimes. You know, anybody who's supporting that is flying in the face of the principles that are laid out in Article 25 of the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court, which essentially says that a person shall be criminally responsible and liable for punishment for a crime within jurisdiction of the court if that person, for the purpose of facilitating facilitating the commission of such a crime, aids, abets, or otherwise assists in the commission or its attempted commission, including providing the means for its commission. In other words, tax revenues.
Right.
So I just want people to know that if you're looking for something to stand on, it's all laid out. All we're asking is that the people that are covering up these crimes be held accountable for what they've done under the rules that are already established, and they are already subject to, already signatories to, that this is all laid out and established. All we have to do is apply the very simple measures that are available to us to uphold and stand on international law.
Here's what happens, of course, Andrew, and you had that experience yourself. One individual tries it, and they come down on you because they don't want an example to spread.
Sure.
And how do we get, and this is kind of the focus of a lot of the work I do these days, is trying to get groups of people, even, starting a movement within your own neighborhood and community, to take back your power, to say, we have the right to convene courts, we have the right to make citizen arrests on known child-raping priests, we have the right to withhold our funds to government when it's being used for criminal purposes. So it's breaking that ice and getting to a critical mass of where people can feel they can switch allegiance, if you like, to something different. That's the difficult part.
Well, it is the difficult part because we have to come to the realization, and we come to it individually, that unless we take correct action at this stage, we may not have an opportunity to do further down the road. We're already going down a very slippery slope. The time to take care of this is now. If we haven't started taking action, it's time. There's no time to wait. There's no time to delay. If you're listening to this, then presumably you're already taking correct action. And in terms of the growing awareness, those of us who are doing what we're doing, sacrificing what we sacrificed, you've paid a huge price, I know that, to ask people to stand with us and develop the courage and it takes to do what's required.
Especially since, when we look at what not even a couple of dozen of us achieved in Canada, we changed the whole narrative on genocide, on child abuse, and you see the ripple effects all over the world from this now. I mean, all the stuff in the press now about child trafficking, child abuse. The fact that in Canada nobody can even claim anymore that children didn't die, which they did before. Like, a few of us can shift it, and that's going back to Sun Tzu and the Art of War. It doesn't matter what your size. If you're attacking what your enemy loves, it doesn't matter how big they are, they have to respond. And that's exactly what we did. So I wanted to say to people, you can read all of this, some of our books, put in my name, Kevin Annett, at Amazon.com, especially come up with two books that are really in demand these days, which is the Common Law Training Manual and Whistleblower's Manual, both of which you can get. And it gives people concrete tools to use. For example, there's some people who want to form a common law inquiry, I guess you could call it, if you're in the States, you call it a grand jury inquiry, into the use of smart meters. We keep getting this all the time from people. And how do you do it? Well, you got to document the problem for it, just like we did with the church-led genocide. You got to have the concrete evidence. And what I find interesting, Andrew, is when you're standing on evidence, these people in these so-called powerful institutions go crazy.
Yeah.
They start calling you names, they start attacking you, they go after you legally. But the point is that proves that they're guilty and that you're standing on something very powerful. So that's been our experience. It doesn't take a lot of us, but it's where we're placed strategically and how persistent we are.
Well, that's right. More and more people are coming around to recognizing that all of it is rigged. While times have been good, people have been able to coast and just get along. That's changing rapidly from what I'm reading. I hear that over half of Canadians, for example, are less than $200 away from not making their monthlies. Hearing more and more stories of people not making their rent payments, even though the rental market's full. And now the Bank of Canada has doubled its interest rate so far this year. It doesn't sound like much, 0.5 to 1%, but it's a doubling. And if the trend continues, within a year or two, you know, when the bubble bursts and Canadians realize the extent to which they've been had and move from complacency to pain, that's when I think we're going to see a real shift in awareness and shift in trust. And we'll see. We'll see whether, you know, the timing is such that people have already become too unskilled and too soft and just get taken out as the financial collapse happens, or whether people wake up and recognize
maybe that's why
the whole thing is false, and we'd better start working together as we used to do.
Maybe that's one of the reasons that so few people do actually respond to the work we're doing. The level of fear. It's funny because, for example, one of the things we always talk about is, well, you, in the same way that you don't pay taxes to a criminal government, you also don't give tithing or funding to these churches.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't people get on board with this to say, look, why should we allow tax exemptions to these churches that committed such heinous crimes and are still doing it under their
sure.
own rules?
That's a great question. How come they get off $15 to $20 billion a year? How come we send concordats to the Catholic Church? You know, how
right.
come? You know, it is Canada a genocidal regime? Did the Indian Act get used as a template for the apartheid regime in South Africa? Is that true? Just, again, back to informing ourselves and asking these tough questions. If enough people ask these people enough hard questions and demand the answers, and make the people that are doing this work, make it extremely difficult for them to face what they're doing without also having to face their complicity in crimes against humanity.
Right. Well, here's some concrete info for people, because I know some of the people who are listening did want to have some idea about, well, how do you hit these churches where it hurts? One of them is you find they're in their the people who provide them insurance, their insurance underwriters and brokers.
Mm-hmm.
And here's some concrete info. All the Catholic churches in North America are, not surprisingly, have their own in-house insurance company called the Catholic Mutual Group. You could go, everyone look this up online. Do your own research. Catholic Mutual Group. It provides insurance coverage for 125 dioceses and 200 religious orders all over North America. But guess what? Just like with the Vatican Bank, you can't know anything about them. There's no Wikipedia references to this Catholic Mutual Group. They're self-owned. There's no corporate ties with any other body. And they're the ones who provide the insurance to all the priests and bishops who are buggering kids and getting away with these crimes. So the interesting thing, too, when you look at the United Church, their organization, that their underwriter is called Hub International, which is part of this thing called the Royal Sun Alliance, based in London, England. One of the most sued insurance companies in the world, involved in fraudulent claims, in not providing, they're following through on their policies. And also, with the insurance underwriters in the Anglican Church, it's called Aon Reed Stenhouse. Guess what? They actually owned office space in one of the 9/11 towers, but about a month before the planes hit, guess who moved out and moved their operations to London, England? They were then accused of paying off government officials in 18 different countries with bribes to get insurance contracts. These are the ones insuring the Church of England. And, you know, it's kind of like part of the strategy is you go to these insurance companies, they make a stink, and you say, it's not illegal for you to insure criminal bodies. And I can tell you, Andrew, if these people have their, you know, it's often said that the threat is just as potent as the action itself, if you're striking at what people love. If these churches know that we're going after their insurance coverage, it's the one thing that forced them to start to admit stuff about the residential schools. We're threatening their bank accounts. It's the only thing they understand. So I think this is the kind of research and information and action people need to start to do.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely. Make them liable. Take away their protection. Yes. Yeah, people don't like being exposed, that's for sure.
Yep. And so we're going to have more on that in future shows, some things people are going to do about that. But I want to get to some other issue. We've only got about 10 minutes left. The hour goes really quick, unfortunately, on this show. But one of the things that people did ask leading up to the show was the whole question of the campaign we mounted to expose these crimes. What is it that you really, and here's a question from one of the listeners, what is it that you really think caused these churches to start admitting things? What is it? And I think I just answered that in a way, but what's your take on that, Andrew?
What caused them to start admitting things?
Yeah.
Well, there's really just a bit of limited fallout, and I think that's what they're hoping to do, is if they can admit, say, 10%, they can probably still hope to hide the other 90%.
Yeah.
I really don't think that there's any desire on the part of these people to come clean, as it were. Yeah. And I think evidence of that, I mean, a lot of people seem to think that the current pope is somehow a better pope than his predecessors, but I read that he's said there's such a backlog of investigations to be done, some 2,000 priests accused of not screwing children, that rather than get the resources to get the investigation going, they just flushed the backlog, so one of these 2,000 people won't investigate it.
Well, he's a Bergoglio, a so-called Pope Francis, is a strong adherent to the crimen solicitandis policy, where you cover up in-house crimes.
Right.
He trafficked children in Argentina when he was Archbishop there. I mean, it goes on and on.
Yeah. So how do we, you know, we know the mainstream press is the most controlled, well, especially here in Canada, the most controlled in the world. And so you're always reading articles about how, you know, how good it all is, how it's all transformed and all the rest of it. Are people still laughing this up, do you think? Are people still believing it?
Well, you know, it's almost like it doesn't enter their lives. I mean, you know, when you talk to people about churches, because they don't have an experience of it, they think they go by the popular version of what a church is, or their memory from Sunday school or something. But they don't understand, like, here's a classic example. When I took up before I got thrown out of the United Church, I worked as the urban ministry worker at a place called Fred Victor Mission in downtown Toronto. And we found out very quickly, because they knew everyone on staff, they were laundering money. This is the largest United Church. It's still in operation. It runs a thing called Keith Whitney Housing for the Homeless in Toronto off Queen Street. And people on staff were coming to me saying there's drug dealing going on in the mission. They're laundering money. There's over $1.5 million not accounted for. There's some really crooked stuff going on there. We went to the police, and they literally told us to back off, and they even threatened us. Okay.
Right.
And then more people came forward with even more horrendous stories of sexual assault going on in the mission. The police turned their blind eye. This is the tacit immunity that these churches have. They're a law unto themselves. They can do whatever they like. They can even kill children and get away with it. That's what we're dealing with. Would you allow a neighbor to operate like that?
Well, and as you've proven, the government has given you a letter saying that what the church does is beyond their purview, that they're not accountable to the Attorney General's office in B.C. So
that's
there
right,
you go. We literally, you know, perhaps we really do have separation of church and state.
Well, they're not. Yeah, they're not accountable, and they can do that to anybody they like, and they can, you know, that's. So, if that's the reality, people don't want to look at it, so they prefer to fall back under the illusion, and it's a way to survive, maybe, psychologically, you know.
That's essentially what it is. People are, you know, as long as people are motivated and. You know, by the fear of being made homeless is the big one, right? I mean, that's what people see, is if they rock the boat, then they'll be the ones on the street begging for food and dying young.
Yeah, but don't forget now, I want to end, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to end on a really important point for people, and that is that we did have an impact. We did change things. These people are not immovable or immortal, that they're just people hiding behind this corporate structure, and they can be gotten to. So, that's something we're going to be talking about in future shows, how it's worked and how people are trying to make it work now. The trouble is that we tend to view ourselves in a very individualistic way, like we're on our own, we're vulnerable, they can pick us off. We've got to learn to start standing together, and maybe that's something we should talk about as our final point.
Absolutely, we have to stand together.
How to do
together.
It.
And you know, it's definitely time, you know, for people to recognize the conditions are about to change. And there's no choice. You know, we have to recreate a society that works for all of us and not for a parasitic elite. They've been exposed. We know who they are and the people that support them, and it's time to turn our backs on them. It's time for everybody to stop saying, what can I do, and recognize for ourselves that each of us can do and contribute and do that, and not wait another moment. You know, what are you waiting for is the question.
Well, I often say to people, there's three aspects to sovereignty. There's personal, there's spiritual, there's political, right? And taking back the personal is the first step. And, you know, I find it doesn't happen in the abstract. It comes from your own experience, understanding your own experience, owning it, saying, I can't lie about what I'm in or what I've gone through anymore, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Any final words, Andrew? Any things you want to leave us with?
Well, I'd like to encourage everyone to keep the faith, keep moving forward, that we are in a period of change. These people are being exposed, and now is the time to recreate this world the way we've been hoping to for a very long time. Thank you very much for having me on the show today, and look forward to being back again soon one day.
Oh, well, you will be, and we'll talk again soon, Andrew. I really appreciate it. Your presence today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin. And for the rest of you who are listening, to remind you again, next week is Daylight Saving Time, so put your clock back. We're here at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, bbsradio.com/radiofree. I'm sorry, here we stand. We used to be Radio Free Kanata, and we've evolved. We've moved on, moved up and on. We're not just about Kanata anymore, but the world. Here we stand. And one final point as well to remember is that we have tools, we have means for people to fight. We're not just the steam, we also are the piston. We have a way to energize and organize what we're doing. So please write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com, go to itccs.org, murderbydecree.com, and it's always an honor and privilege to be with you folks. And please write to us, let us know what you think, and be involved. If you have ideas for programs, guests, write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. And don't forget, this week, 500th anniversary of the Reformation on Tuesday. Celebrate it. And do what Martin Luther did. Nail something to the door of a church. We've got stuff you can nail, so write to us, and we will send it to you. So until next week, brothers and sisters, stay strong, stay clear, and we're leaving with words by, and a song by Phil Oakes, folk singer from the 60s. Thank you. See you next week.
Jesus was a working man and a hero, you will hear. Born in the town of Bethlehem at the turning of the year, at the turning of the year. When Jesus was a little lad, streets rang with his name.